Hi everyone, I'm MH, or with the new name Real Life Sultanas, and this will be the first podcast video of my channel, so I'm a little bit nervous, but I hope you will like it. In this first video, I would like to talk about the whole origin and formation of the Ottoman Empire, and mostly I would like to focus on Ertuğrul and Osman, since they were the first ones, and I know that you asked me a lot of questions about them. So yeah, I choose this topic because I get a lot of questions about Ertuğrul and about the series Dirilish Ertuğrul and Kurulus Osman. And actually, these first centuries are very important to the better understanding of the Ottoman Empire and even the Sultanate of Women. I really hope that you will enjoy the video. So please leave comments and tell me your honest opinion about the video and about this whole. Really, please be honest. Also, I would like to thank you very much for a lot of questions. I try to build them up into my text. Of course, there will be some that I can't answer because we simply don't know. We have simply no evidences. But I will try to do my best about answering even these questions. First of all, I know that you are very interested about this whole Ertuğrul thing, so I would like to start with him. The series is one of the best series nowadays, and I'm also totally obsessed with it. I know, I'm always complaining about how they changed history in Muhteşem Yüzyıl and Muhteşem Yüzyıl Kasam. But I have never complained about the same thing with Dirilish Ertuğrul. But this is not because they did everything perfectly fine, but because we nearly know nothing about Ertuğrul. So they simply cannot follow history because we know so little about this man. So mostly the series were based on the legends about Ertuğrul. And since we really have very, very few informations about him, I also tried to put these legends into this video. There were a lot of nomad folks in Anatolia in the 13th century. The tribe of Ertuğrul or Osman, so basically the Ottomans, appear to have entered Anatolia either just before or immediately after the Mongol incursion of the 1240s and 1250s. So maybe they really fled from the Mongols as they portrayed in the series, and this is why they entered to Anatolia. Ottoman tradition says Ertuğrul's tribe arrived in the frontier zone between the weakened Seljuk polity and the weakened Byzantine Empire. In particular, the nomads and other followers lived in a tribally organized group, and they enjoyed pastures and cultivable lands between Eskişehir and what is now known as Bilecik. So actually this place was Sylt. So they were nomads, most probably from Central Asia, and a lot of you asked about their daily life. How they lived, what they wore, how they spent their days. So before going into the mysterious details about Ertuğrul's life, let's discuss the daily life of these nomad people. Like any nomads, they live from animal husbandry. So basically, they pursue the nomadic lifestyle. Their tents, or other ways called yurts, were set up where they found a suitable pasture for their animals. So this part is depicted in a completely fair way in the series as well. However, as we saw in the series, the main problem and the whole main part of the first season was the migration of the tribe. And actually, this was exactly the same in real life, because migration was a growing problem for these people as states began to form everywhere around them. So they could only move into a limited direction. So they really felt that they should settle down. But of course this didn't happen overnight. It was a longer situation. Their daily lives were filled with grazing and caring for their animals. Actually, there was differences between how the men, how the children, and how the women spent their days. Actually, about caring the animals, it was usually done by young children. It was common and still common for children in nomadic tribes to take care of the animals. Among the men, there were of course a few who also took care of the animals. There were some who did some other kind of works, like some of them were blacksmiths, as we also saw it in the series. And of course, there were some men who were warriors, Alps, as they called it in the series, Alpler, Alp. Actually, it's interesting, and I really wanted to mention this because you also asked, and I really found it very, very interesting that there are more and more evidences that suggest that the Turk nomadic woman also understood swordsmanship. So then they knew how to fight, and they also fought. Actually, they needed it since they lived their life under constant threat, and their husbands were often away from home with the animals, so they really had to be able to defend themselves. A few days ago, I found a very, very interesting topic, article. It was about that in Central Asia, some Turk and Mongol tombs were excavated, and they found some female remains in these graves, and these remains clearly indicate that these women rode horses regularly. In addition, deformities can be observed on their bodies, proving that they used weapons regularly. So it's just amazing, really. Okay, of course it wasn't a grave from Ertuğrul's period from Anatolia, but it was from Central Asia and a little bit earlier. But in my opinion, this may have been similar with the Ottomans also in Ertuğrul's time, because if we see it logically, these women were at home with their children, without the warriors and without the men, and the Mongols were always beside them. So they really had to fight. They really had to know how to fight and how to save their life, how to save their children's life, how to save their tribes. So yeah, I really think that these women know how to fight, and they did. Then over time, as these nomads settled down, women no longer had to fight. Anyhow, in addition to wearing weapons, these women, like other nomads, spent most of their lives with cooking, raising children, but they were also involved in making carpets, as they showed in the series. In fact, Ottoman rugs were very great works, and still they are, so it is totally imaginable that these women sell their rugs to make money. It's totally fair and was portrayed quite accurate, I think. Okay, so yeah, this is what I wanted to tell you about this this nomadic lifestyle. And now go back to Ertuğrul. We know nothing about his life, and even his existence is questionable. According to a tradition, he was from the Kayi tribe, son of Süleyman Shah and Hayme Hatun, and was born around 1200. But we have to admit, of course it can be, but there are no evidences. What we may know about him, or what we think we know about him, were all written centuries later. So actually, we really have very, very few evidence that even, I mean, we don't even know if he was a real historical character. Maybe he was just a legend, you know, his name, Ertugrul, also suggests some legendary more than a real person. But okay, of course, let's say he was a historical person. But still, it's a very complex topic. I had a few arguments, even on YouTube and on other platforms, about this, because I really am not sure about this whole Ertugrul thing is real, that he was really a Kayi Bey and he was the father of Osman. I'm still not sure. And people say to me, after these kind of fights, that but hey, his grave is in Saud, and his wife's grave is also in Saud, and Haymana's and Turgut's grave are all in Saud. So how could they not be historical person? And yeah, I got it. But these graves are not original ones. They were built by Abdulhamid II centuries later. He wanted to show his respect with building the Ertugrul, and he wanted to show the greatness of the whole Ottoman dynasty and the dynastical family. So all in all, I know it's not a popular opinion, but it's not even sure that Ertugrul was the father of Osman and he was a historical person. I mean, most sources and legends agree that Osman was very young when he became a bey after a bloody family fight, which is also a very interesting topic, but about this I will talk later. So, Osman was young when he became a bey, and this would suggest that he was born somewhere around 1260. But legends say Ertugrul was born around 1200, which means he fathered Osman when he was around 60. Okay, I know it's possible, but let's continue. Legends say Halime was the wife of Ertugrul and she was around the same age as him. So this clearly not make it possible that Halime was the mother of Osman, because okay, Ertugrul as a man can produce children in his 60s, but no woman can do it. So maybe Ertugrul had more wives, or maybe Halime was younger than him. Anyhow, the problem here is, again, we don't know anything about Halime. I know you also asked me about her, and in Dirilish Ertugrul they portrayed her as a Seljuk princess. But actually, there are no evidences for this. There are no evidences about her whole existence. In my opinion, it wouldn't really make sense for a princess to marry a nomad man. So I think that even if Halime was a real historical figure, she would never be a Seljuk princess. I'm really sorry, because I know that you want to know more about Halime, and I really wish I could tell you more about her, because she was my absolutely favorite character in the series, and I don't want to go spoilers, so I won't say anything more. I just really loved her character, and I would be very, very happy if I could tell you more about her, but the sad fact is we don't know anything about her. I'm checking the questions meanwhile. You asked me about Osman's brothers. Well, legends say that he had two brothers, Gündüz Bey and Savcı Bey, but we don't know anything about them. I mean, nothing exact. Of course, there are legends about them. For example, that they supported their brother Osman, which is very strange, since both were older than him, but they still accepted Osman as the bey as the ruler of the tribe. So it really suggests to me that Osman really was a true-born leader. Because if he wouldn't be a capable man, why would his older brother support him as a bait? It does not make sense. And also, the relationship between Osman, Gündüz and Savcı gives us a little hint about brotherly relationships of this period. And I really find it interesting how different was this than in the later periods when brothers killed each other continuously. So, okay, now I don't want to go into details about fratricide because this will be a topic of another video. But still, it's very interesting for me that in the earlier periods, and not just with Osman, but some other sultans also have the same brother relationship. It's very interesting that they really had a true brother relationship. It's quite rare in the Ottoman family. So, as I'm seeing the questions, if I left out something... Yeah. Okay. You asked me about the clothes and jewels. Yeah, I know it's a very interesting topic. And I always feel sad when I can't answer this question about the Sultanate of Women. And now I'm so happy that I can answer this question. This is the first time in my life that I can answer this question. Because about this early period, we have more information about the clothes than in the later periods. So, I must say that in Dirilish Ertuğrul they made perfect costumes. Really, they were absolutely historically accurate. Because in these days, even if they were Muslims, the nomads and semi-nomadic women weren't veiled. In these early periods, when they barely entered to Anatolia, the women most probably wore the same dresses as the ones in Central Asia. So let me tell you about these classical Central Asian Turk dresses. It is very, very characteristic of the people of Central Asia that women dressed the same as men. The reason for this was the same lifestyle. I mean, both men and women was riding horse and use weapons, as I already mentioned before, so there was no need for different dresses. An average woman's top wear was a T-shaped kaftan-like coat, actually, which was buttoned in the middle and cut out of both sides and on the back at the waist, so they could easily ride the horse while wearing it. Its edges were decorated with furs or metal fittings or some embroideries, and these kaftans were fastened with a belt at their waist, both in the case of women and both in the case of men. Under this kaftan, they wore loose and tight-fitting pants. Pants were the suitable dress for even women because they could easily horse riding wearing this. The woman's outerwear was the same whether it was worn by a princess, a noble lady, or by a simple woman. The only difference was in the decoration. The poor woman didn't wear some luxury materials, but they wore homemade clothes made of thicker linen or wool. But all of the women wore low-legged boots, the same as men, again, and they wore thick stocking underneath it. They used very colorful textiles, and they also used embroidery into their dresses, in their kaftans. So that's all about the dresses. Let's talk about the jewels. In Muhteşem Yüzyıl, it was just too much, and we will discuss it in another podcast. But the jewels in Dirili Sertrul were absolutely accurate again. This woman wore earrings, bracelets, and rings mostly, and there was also a special kind of jewel. This woman put some silver or gold ornaments into their braids, into their hair, to make it also look nice. So yeah, these were the main jewels. Necklaces were quite rare, but when they have some, then they were made the same way as the bracelets. Both were made of twisted wires and were connected at their ends by a loop and hook, so actually the same way as we do it nowadays. Presumably they also used beads, I mean pearls, but this was not worn as a pearl necklace, for example, but they sewn one by one on their clothes these pearls. So they use this as a decoration on their clothes and not really as a jewel. Some bracelets and rings have real gemstone in it. So basically, the jewels and the dresses were also very portrayed very, very accurate in Dirili Sertrul and also in Kurulus Osman. So if you are interested about how they looked like, I really suggest you this series, because it's really accurate. Of course, when these tribes settled down in Anatolia, they regularly had contact with the Seljuks and with the Byzantine culture, and of course these cultures affected their own culture and of course their dresses. So with times, the clothes changed. Now, as I'm watching the questions, I think all of the ones about Sertrul and the nomadic lifestyle were answered. So, I think we can move on to Osman. Okay, about Osman, almost nothing is known. Again, surprise. Of course, he was the founder of the House of Osman, the man remembered as the first of the Ottoman sultans. No one knows when or where he was born, and for a long time, not even a single artifact existed that could be confidently dated to his lifetime. There are two coins, one in a private collection in London and the other in Istanbul Archaeological Museum. Which are about Osman. But what we know about him, who was he? We have so many questions and we have very, very few answers. As we already discussed, legends say that he was the son of Ertuğrul Bey and Halime Hatun, but there are no exact evidences for that. And his birth date is also not really suggest this. But anyhow, legends say that after Ertuğrul's death, he became the bey of the tribe. But his uncle Dündar didn't want to accept him as the bey, so they had a fight, and in the end Osman killed him. Well, the modern sources and the sources from the 16th century, not really talking about this, because they find it not too glorious to kill your own uncle for the throne. Okay, anyhow, even if he killed his own uncle, it wasn't a special thing, knowing the later periods when brothers fought against each other, so anyhow, it wasn't a big deal. Osman as a bey was loyal to the Seljuks at first, but then he began to act independently around 1300. The reason of this act is not known, but legends say that the whole idea of the empire, and so his kind of rebel against the Seljuks began quite literally with a dream. This legend say that one night the first Sultan Osman was sleeping in the house of a holy man called Edebali when he saw that the moon rose from the holy man's breast and came to sink in his own breast. A tree then poured from his navel and its shade compassed the world. Beneath this shade there were mountains and streams flowed forth from the foot of each mountain. Some people drank from these running waters, others watered gardens, while yet others caused fountains to flow. When Osman awake, he told the story to this holy man, who then said, "Osman, my son, congratulations, for God has given the imperial office to you and your descendants, and my daughter Malhun shall be your wife." So this legend is very, very nice and everything, but most probably this is just a legend. Actually, these kind of dreams have a history with these nomad people. For example, in the early Hungarian history, there is also a dream like this called the Emeses dream. This one is basically the same, and sorry, but as a Hungarian, I must tell you about this one, but I will cut it short, I promise. So, this woman, Emese, was the mother of Ámos, the head of the first Hungarian king dynasty. In the legend, Emese, the wife of Chief Ügyek, was impregnated by a Turul bird. The Turul appeared to her in a dream and told her that from her womb a great river would begin and flow out over strange lands. And according to dream interpreters, this meant that she would give birth to a son who would let his people out of their homeland, and that her descendants would be glorious kings. So anyhow, in the end, Emese gave birth to a son and named him Ámos, which name derives from the Hungarian word álom, meaning dream. Thus, Ámos can be interpreted as the dreamt one. Fun fact is that the name Emese had a Turk origin actually. It originated from the old Turk Eme or Ana word, which means mother. But okay, that's enough about Hungarian history here. I just had to say this because really this whole dream legends are very, very common in the Central Asian nomadic cultures, and both Turks and Hungarians were originated from there. So yeah. Anyhow, Osman had his dream or not, but let's say he had. And then he started to build an empire, actually. His first indisputable evidence comes from a Byzantine chronicler who tells the story of the Battle of Bephus, quite near to Nicomedia, which is now called Izmit. And this battle happened in July of 3002, in which Osman and the force of nomad archers defeated a Byzantine force. It is possible that bad weather upstream and rare flood of the Sakarya River downstream made it attractive to Osman and other Turk bays to seek to recoup damage to their herds in the lowlands. And at this time, Osman was actually no more powerful than a number of other minor bays, so he was nothing special, just a simple bay. But then this weather and the flood of the river helped him to become a very well-known bay. Within a very short time, Turk raiders had reached the Sea of Marmara, and from this period, a contemporary Byzantine chronicler describes how news of Osman's victories spread and attracted Turks from other areas of Western Anatolia or Eastern Anatolia to join his following, and how his force was strong enough to defeat a Byzantine army near Nicomedia, so near Izmit. So basically, thanks to the flood, Osman was able to win a very big battle, then the other nomadic tribes felt that, oh, he's someone, we should maybe meet him, and then they started to follow him. And in the end, from their base in the Sakarya Wali, where Osman had occupied the old Byzantine fortified places. So basically, Osman settled in the Sakarya Wali, and from there he and his men plundered the countryside to the west, forcing the inhabitants into the walled towns. And these remained secure since Osman obviously lacked the military skills to undertake formal sieges. His assault on Nicaea failed, unfortunately, and he also took several other fortresses and fortified towns in the Sakarya Valley, using them to store his plunder. In a similar manner, he destroyed the countryside around Bursa, but also failed to take the city. So actually he became well known, he became powerful, but still he didn't really was able to conquest real towns. The date of Osman's death is uncertain, but he probably died by 1324. This date can be actually accepted because there was a Moroccan world traveler, Ibn Battuta, who visited this south area in 1331, and he wrote that Osman was buried in the mosque of Bursa. Probably it was a former church. Anyhow, so he was buried there, and he was already dead when this guy was in Ceut, so he must die before this date. And his son Orhan mentions actually the date of 1324 as the date of the death of Osman. Actually, the church or mosque in which he was buried is no longer standing due to an earthquake 200 years ago. So Osman's remains now lie next to those of Orhan, father and son in suitable twin mausoleum erected in 1863. But these mausoleums are not the original ones. It seems like we know a lot of about Osman, isn't it? However, in reality, we know very little. Even his name is the subject of some controversy, according to Douglas A. Howard, who is a historian. He wrote that a Greek historian who gave us the description of the Sakarya flood, in which Osman became famous, and he and other contemporary writers who mentions Osman's name did not call him the name Osman, but rather Ataman. The surprising notion that Osman had another name finds support in two later sources also. So actually it's maybe true that Osman wasn't even named Osman, but Ataman. Ataman actually is a Turkish name, or maybe a Mongol one, while Osman is absolutely a Muslim name. This had led to some suspicions that Osman or Ataman, the Ottoman, might have been born a pagan, and that he later became a Muslim, and he take the name Osman. when he became a Muslim. But if this would be true, then if Osman were indeed a convert to Islam, who changed his name? Why would his sons have kept their genuinely Turkish names? I mean, Orhan is a Turkish name, and yeah, so it's very very interesting question. I'm not saying this is the situation, but it's really interesting. From what the Greek historian wrote about, the only thing we can surmise of the Turk he called Ataman is that he was a warrior. Maybe this Ataman is just some misspell or some language difference caused the problem. But anyhow, it's interesting. At least I find it interesting. All in all, it was Osman who was the founder of the Ottoman Empire and who was to give his name to the Ottoman or Osmanli dynasty. But it was under his son Orhan that the little principality began to acquire more settled aspect. Osman's territory had contained no large towns, but in 1326, however, the city of Bursa succumbed to starvation and became, from this date, the first capital of the Ottomans. In the next year following an earthquake which damaged its fortifications, Orhan's men occupied the Byzantine town of Lopadion, with other name Ulubat, towards the Dardanelles. I don't really want to go into details about Orhan's and his successor lives, because I'm already talking too long, and if I would go into details, I would talk for a whole day. Maybe in another podcast we will also discuss them. The only thing I really want to talk about with Orhan is that he was the first one to establish an Ottoman bridgehead in Europe. He achieved this by exploiting a civil war in Byzantium between the rival emperors, John Kantakouzenos and John Palaiologos. Kantakouzenos sought allies among the Turkish ruler of Western Anatolia, and in 1346 formed a pact with Orhan by marrying him to his daughter Theodora. The strategy was successful, and Kantakouzenos entered Constantinople and proclaimed himself an emperor. So, beside his great victories, Orhan was the first one who used marriage as a tool to get himself supporters. And this is very, very important, knowing the history of marriage in the later periods. But of course, this topic will be discussed in another podcast later. I just really wanted to mention that Orhan was the first one who really took advantage of marriages. So thank you for listening to me, and I hope you enjoyed this also. I know it's not like my videos, but I hope that the ones who are here for the history will like this podcast also. So please leave comments, tell me your honest opinion about this whole, and when I found out what should be the next topic, I will post it and ask for your questions again. And I really hope that I answered all of your questions. But if I failed or you have new questions, feel free to comment and let's discuss. So thank you again, I hope you enjoyed. And have a nice day, guys. Bye.